The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So low battery. We all know how that feels. And then the little toggle switch falls off. And we are broken down. And this breakdown, not a mistake. There's a wonderful koan in the Gateless Gate about a wheel maker who made wheels and carts and a master. And the question is when the wheel and the axle fall off, what is vividly apparent when the cart breaks down? And a cart, a wonderful thing to carry heavy loads with very little effort, not to have to bear the whole weight yourself. So the cart is a wonderful invention. We might say that the self is a wonderful invention to move us around the world, make sure we get food and find a nice warm house like this on a day when it is so bitterly cold outside. And these selves, these bodies, these personalities, this collection of data points, everything you remember and everything you don't remember, all here right now, in our practice and in our life, this breaks down. In most ways it appears that this breakdown is a design flaw. Somehow God or whoever made the universe didn't get it quite right. If she had gotten it right, there would be no sickness, old age, or death. But as we look deeper into this matter, the matter not really of Buddhism, We certainly look through the Zen Buddhist lens, but we are looking at something much more important than philosophy. We are each one of us looking into what it means to be alive, how to bear the vividness of our life. How to bear the 10,000 joys and sorrows, this life that sometimes seems endless, no end to our difficulty, no end to what we have to do next. And in the next moment seems so brief. Just the other night, someone came in for a meeting and said, my dear old teacher, and indeed I have become old here in this walking around, breathing, eating, shitting, pissing, have done it for quite a number of years now. And still it is a mystery to me. This functioning of life, this self, this body, this being that I am. And so here on retreat, each one of us has the great privilege to encounter ourself, the great root koan, who am I? Who am I? Of course, we think we know. But when we look closer, it's quite impossible to find some entity who is responsible for this. But we get to move toward ourself, close the gap between yourself and yourself. As we move to close this gap, we encounter our whole life. The little self does not want to die. It wants to continue fabricating the narrative. It wants to maintain its sense of difference. And part of our practice here on retreat is to blend in with our ritual, with our walking, and as we walk, as we bow, the point is to be ordinary, nothing special. Can we practice without it being about us? Which fortunately brings me to the point I wanted to talk about in point six, the discipline of relationships. Slogan 36, don't be tricky. Don't be tricky. if we stated this another way, it might be ordinary. Simple. And I see this in two ways. The first is making everything quite complicated. That all of these teachings and all of the things we say go into our mind, and if we try to figure it out, as Katagiri Roshi said in the short excerpt we read today, your head hurts. There are too many concepts, too many six this and seven that's, and this form and emptiness, and all of this, the lattice of Zen, the lattice of Buddhism, from one perspective, quite lovely, and scholars spend decades, give their life to studying these beautiful, delicate, very precise teachings. And that is wonderful. We can appreciate their work in entering through that way. But in the Zen tradition, in particular, we emphasize another point of entry into Buddha's teachings, and the point of entry is your own life, your own experience. Actually, when we do our individual meetings, you come up and you say your name, and then we ask you to say your practice. And these practices that we talk about are actually quite straightforward and simple. You can follow your breath or count your breath, being with the breath and body. You can sit in open awareness, shikantaza, we call it, allowing what is here to be here. You can work on koans. Of course, there are many others, but it's hard to keep it simple. We human beings, want to make it more complicated. So we make up all of these internal rules for how we should do this and how we should do this. First I go here and then I go there. The encouragement in don't be tricky, is to keep coming back to just this practice. For me, my main practice for decades and decades now is the breath. And oftentimes when people come, it's the first practice we assign, and some people think, well, that's a beginner practice. I want to move on to the real stuff. But the beginner practice is the end practice as well. This breathing practice, infinitely deep, because each moment and each thing is revealing the whole universe. Alan spoke a while back about Indra's net and this image of the universe as a web, and in each intersection of this giant net there is a jewel, and each jewel reflects all of the other jewels in the universe. And what a lovely way to think about, to dream into this mysterious life. That everything is contained in everything. There is no separate thing that is not wholly dependent on everything else. So this don't be tricky is in some ways this encouragement to simplicity. Don't think that if you make up some fancy practice that it is better. For me, I do this somehow unconsciously. I'm not quite sure how it happens, but my practice gets more and more complicated, and every once in a while I realize, I'm trying so hard to do something that I've quite lost the basics. Resolve to begin. Always go back. Always go back to the basics. And it is quite mysterious to me that being with the breath, that paying attention to the breath and sitting in this upright posture, that in doing this that we might grow in love and understanding. Not through figuring things out, not through getting things right or wrong, but in this the great patience that is required. Patience, one of the six Mahayana paramitas, the perfections or qualities of practice. Generosity is first. Approaching our life, approaching our practice with the spirit of giving, of benefiting all beings. And then discipline or virtue is next, requiring us to be firm with ourselves, to actually have a yes and have a no, so that when the bell rings, we don't say, well, there's no right or wrong, so I think I'll just stay in the parlor and sip my coffee and read a book. So no right or wrong, but we vow to practice together. We could say, too, that this is a game that we're playing together. Not that this is the only game human beings can play or the only way to do spiritual work, but there are rules in the game that we take on. Take on not as truth and not as right or wrong, but joining in together. Again, so that the point is not that I have to have my own way. What if I don't have to decide? And the great freedom of retreat and the great freedom of discipline is that you don't have to spend your time deciding to take the left fork or the right fork. You can just bell rings, and then we come into the meditation hall. And it's a very particular kind of freedom. But Shunryu Suzuki, who interestingly we've been referring to a lot, certainly a part, a huge part of the American Zen tradition, through his Norman Fisher, one of the Dharma heirs in his lineage, through Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, but he said, I think in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that in our upright Zazen, we, each one of us, perfectly express ourself. Although the posture is a firm base, knees on the ground, feet on the floor, butt on the chair or the cushion, and the spine elongated, rising up, the back of the neck long, shoulders released. Each one of us sitting in the same posture, and yet each one of us utterly unique. And each one of us doing our Zazen, that is a perfect expression of our self. This self, that self that we can never know. You cannot find this self that you are, this light that you are in the world, is invisible to you. It is just who you are. There is no other life. And on this retreat, we've had a number of different timers, and the timer, the Jiki, also leads the walking. And for me, so lovely to walk behind each of our different timers, each one so perfectly expressing themselves in their walk. And this morning, our new Jiki Carol gave her a Dharma talk of walking, and I was grateful to receive to walk in this way. And each one of us walks, expressing our love and our wisdom, expressing our confusion and our pain. All of this shines forth. So often we imagine that we are revealing parts of ourselves and holding back other parts, but not so much. Each one of us, as we say, bringing everything to this moment, and the everything that you bring is unlimited and cannot be contained in a name or cannot be described. But a burning life, truly, each one of us is a burning bush, oxidizing. Oxygen comes in, we burn, and we take our food in and burn up the food, and we live our life. And so this complicating practice, this encouragement to stay simple and in the simplicity, each breath is its own teaching, beginning, middle, and end. And each one invites us into our life. Each one expresses our life. There is no life without breath, no breath without life. Breathing is living. Here we are. And the other direction on this of don't be tricky is one we've talked about before, but the kind of we've talked about a Barry Magid's secret practice. So one way of being tricky in our practice and in our life is when we do one thing to make another thing happen, or I do this so that I will get that. And from the ordinary daily perspective, this is good. If you want a clean room, when you take off your clothes, hang them up. Reminds me that when I was growing up, my brother's a year older than me, and we shared a room until we were about, I think, 12 and 13, and it was quite difficult for me because my brother was quite messy and our room was always messy. And then we moved to a new house and each of us got our own room. But the problem was that my room stayed messy even without my brother. This was a surprise to me because I was sure I knew where the problem was. So I had to begin to learn, and still not so good at that. I used to pay my sisters to help me clean my room. I would lie on the bed, and they would move things around for me, and I would give them a nickel each, and they were quite delighted, and I was quite delighted. The room never looked much better after that, but that was how we did it, my dear sisters. And their lazy older brother. But this mind of, I do this so that will happen. A wonderful mind. But our practice is beyond that. This, and as we read from Shohaku Okumura today, he said, no matter how hard we practice, our motivation for practice is always based on some amount of self-centeredness. We come to practice because we want something for ourselves, and as we've said, this is important to want something. And I think as we walk the life of practice, maybe what we want changes. And that as we practice, he says, the act of truly seeing this self-centeredness is itself Buddha. To awaken to the reality of our delusion is itself Buddha. When Melissa and I began practicing so long ago now, I began hearing these teachings about non-attachments. And it really didn't make sense to me because we had gotten together several years before, and I realized I was and still am quite attached to Melissa. And I thought, how could this be? Are we being encouraged to be automatons where we treat everything equally? And I think this is a beginner misunderstanding of Zen, thinking that Zen somehow is about ending delusion or making us less than human. But it is seeing that this attachment, this liking this and not liking that, is the very fabric of our life. So as we practice, not to imagine that we are somehow pure. It seems to me such a danger for us human beings. This we long so much to be pure, to be righteous, but when we think that we have overcome greed, anger, and ignorance, I am no longer interested in power. I am just doing this for other people, that then we are truly dangerous. So to see how we want to do it right, not a problem. To see how we want the praise of our fellow students or the praise of the teachers, not a problem. We are not trying to get rid of anything, but rather to see clearly this activity, and this activity of being human, of being deluded, is so sweet. is so precious, so poignant. The little self that tries so hard and has tried so hard since you were a little girl or little boy to figure out the right thing to do. Please love me. Please love me. And as we move into our practice, this longing to be loved and accepted is part of our motivation. And as we see into it, we can see the energy of it, that great longing and that great fear, or the great sadness of never feeling connected or close to others. And as we feel that great longing and that great fear, sometimes we can glimpse that the fear itself is Buddha. The longing itself is simply life expressing itself, not right or wrong. There is a way that all of life is a play. I think it's slogan number 2, see everything as a dream. We live in this dream world, and each one of us encountering the universe that we participate in creating. The universe is not something outside of us that we encounter objectively, but something that we co-create. We say codependent arising. The self and the world create each other. And as we touch and are touched by our life, we are transformed. And that from this place of separation, we can appreciate life itself, appreciate God, appreciate the Buddha. Only in the human realm can you wake up. And it is a wonderful thing to join with our life, to close the gap, maybe just for a step or two, maybe just in chopping apples in the kitchen, whatever it is, that this practice, as we go forward, I think, and hope, becomes both an expression of our love, maybe less and less as we see that the road is endless. There is no end point. There is no other point. And then our zazen is not something we do hoping we get enlightened. Although there are deep and wondrous experiences that change us, they don't last. But Katagiri's wonderful encouragement that just resonates with me, and I've spoken about it before and will again, his great love of practice. This is our practice. It is wonderful and beautiful. He doesn't say, it will be wonderful and beautiful when you stop being such an idiot. He said, no, this is our practice, this sitting still and sitting upright, expressing ourself. We express our love, we demonstrate our courage here in our zazen. And he says, in this way, in this simple way, maybe it will always be just this, so we settle in. This is our practice. It is wonderful and beautiful. In this way, let us practice for 3,000 kalpas. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. As you know, this is being recorded, and if you'd like to say something that's not recorded, let us know. We'll be happy to stop the recording. But let's go around and say our names. I'm David.
I'm Melissa.
Carol.
Celia.
Jenny.
Judith.
Susan.
Ray.
Eric.
Helen.
Esther.
So, questions, comments, complaints?
So kind of winding back to near the beginning of your talk where you talked, you know, the don't be tricky.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just, you know, I was just so powerfully reminded of times I thought there was some trick and I should be tricky, you yeah. know, and nobody was going to let me know what it was. Of course not. It was a trick. And that made me think of this story, and there may be more than one story just like this, and I can't even remember who it was about, but it was someone, I think, from, you know, early on in the Americanization of Zen, maybe Robert Aitken or someone like that, who talked about his first meeting with a Zen teacher or a certain kind of Zen teacher who said, what's your name?
Yeah.
And this person, maybe you know who it was convinced that this was, yeah. was a trick, so what's your name? What's your name? God! You know, what, and this goes on and on and on, and finally, this person gets exhausted and says, Alan. And the teacher says, no, we're getting somewhere. And bows and goes. So, you know, nice if you could learn that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was actually George Bowman and Shinryu Suzuki, right?
Yeah, that's the story he tells. Going in for his first meeting with Shinryu Suzuki, who says, what is your name? So... But it does seem like there's a trick. You know, I remember, I'm still this way, but especially at first you hear a koan and it's like, so what's the trick here? You know, and the teacher blabs on about it as if it made sense. And of course you know it doesn't make sense. And so it's like, oh, what's going on here? And to realize, actually, just this is going on. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So, for me, tricky is maybe not, or not the opposite, but you say, don't be tricky, be ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And I would link ordinary more to phony. I mean, as don't be phony, be ordinary. And don't be tricky, be honest.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's my understanding.
Yeah.
You said that tricky is that you do something to get something else, or you do something.
Yeah, that's one of the ways
of yes.
interpreting it here.
yes, I also understand it like this.
Mm-hmm.
That, but it's a. It's a way of behaving dishonestly if you do something to get something else.
Yeah. I like that. I think that that's a nice... so there's so many ways of coming at this. So let's practice honestly, not pretending, not doing it for some other reason, but honestly sit and be ourself and see what happens. Yeah, I think that really is in the spirit of this. Yeah.
And there's so many words you could put on one side or the other, right? With, and I think sometimes the opposite of tricky for me is direct, which I think is close to honest as well. But, you know, just this. No big deal. You know, don't go all over the place. Just come out and do it or come out and say it. That's very highly prized in Zen. To not, as we say in English, beat around the bush. just this, no big deal. And human beings endlessly complicate things. So the other opposite is complicated and simple. You know, so you can feel the energy here.
Mm-hmm. And Trungpa, in his translation, says, don't do things with a twist.
Oh,
so that goes to what you're saying too, the honesty and the directness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But tricks sometimes are necessary, but maybe not in practice.
Well, yeah, I think in our daily life we do things to get something else. You know, you go to the store to get groceries so there'll be food in your refrigerator. I would say that's instrumental activity. I do this so that will happen. And we're so used to doing it that it's kind of a rare thing just to do what we're doing for the sake of doing it. Like, I know sometimes I make doing nothing into a lot of work. Right? I'm really working hard at doing nothing. And that's like, wait a minute, this is not about working hard. Right? But that's kind of that doing it to, for some reason, I don't even know what. But, yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
So I'm not sure the exact words, but I was sort of struck by the phrase about fabricating the narrative. Oh my goodness. I don't know if that's what you said exactly.
It's a good phrase.
Oh my goodness. It just reminds me of how often I do that. Whenever there's a little, well, not so much on retreat, but when there's a little bit of, eh, not like that, why aren't they doing, it's like, then the story goes.
Yeah.
And just to, like, okay.
Right.
It's really here.
Right, right.
Unsatisfactory.
Right, and so quickly it builds up to this grand thing, and then we get very tricky about it. Like, oh yeah, well I'll figure that person out, figure this out, and yeah, how to step it back down? Oh, discomfort. Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Yeah, great.
Reminds me of James Ford's Roshi's description of one of his descriptions of a koan as a presentation of reality and an invitation to intimacy. Mm-hmm. And that invitation to intimacy, for me it sounds like when tricky, it's trying to give you what you want or manipulate, it's moving away from this intimacy with my experience of trying to change it in some way, or give you what you want, or get what I want. But there's that pace of moving away from intimacy with experience, which for me is what I have to keep trusting more and more, as I said, is to trust my own experience that, as you mentioned, it contains everything, the experience. And so how to be intimate with that experience. And you know, when going to see a teacher, what does the teacher want from me? So that's suddenly moving away from my experience to trying to figure out what,
right.
And then give them what they want, which I think I do that a lot in my life anyway. But, you know.
Well, I think we all do. You're pointing out a very common thing. Not all of us, because we all have different kinds of personalities, but many of us are trying to scope out what does the situation want, what does the person want, and then give that to them. There are people, I'm not one of them, so I had to learn about this, who don't really care what other people think, and like deeply don't, and are very preoccupied with what, you know, their own authenticity, and then they make the mistake of not taking other people into account. So you can find, you know, patterns that go both ways. But at least my understanding is more, you know, my experience is more like yours. And part of coming to Dokusan is learning to see that. Not to do it differently, but actually coming in and going, whoa, I just want to be a good girl and give you what you want. And, you know, then that can get really dangerous if the teacher isn't ethical or authentic, him or herself. You know, they seem to want me to do something that doesn't feel right to me. So it's always like a dance in a way between the authenticity of the inner sense of knowing and the authenticity of the not knowing. And finding some way into that together. And just admitting it, I think, is the first step. Mm. you know, just saying, whoa, I've just had 20 doksans out in the corridor. And now I'm here and like, I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, and there are people who thought and plan, spend all the time between doksans figuring out how to show up as some idealization of the self. And that's not what we're interested in. And yet, you can't just not do that. You kind of have to do yourself fully until you're undone. Yeah.
Well, that's like seeing the fabrication of the self.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly.
That because then the self wants to stop the selfing. So, well, this self will stop the selfing, and then it's just another self. Right? But as we see it, oh yeah, and with compassion. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's so easy to get impatient and discouraged, like, oh, I should be a better, you know, whatever. but requiring this endless patience, and not the patience of, well, all right, I'll put up with it. But, sweetie. Yeah, of course, this is what human beings do. Yeah.
Yeah, Eric. Yeah, what strikes me is that we all come from such different places, you know. And, you know, in this room at this moment, at least, we're all white, you know. We all have the means to come here, to pay, to travel.
Mm-hmm.
But there's such variety, you know, people who don't have, people, you know, we do have range of language, I mean, there's some, you know, but in a range of culture, and so what I think about as we're talking is the, you know, the poor black kid in small town Africa, and how does he or she have access to this? And are we welcoming to that in a great wide range of diversity?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to be a part of an exclusive club. I want to be part of a club that's really, you know, respecting the diversity.
It's a big issue in the Americanization of Buddhism. So you know, there's a lot that's being written about and talked about, and I think it's very important to stay awake to that. You know, that the world is full of suffering. So how are we gonna practice the Dharma and not just keep it as a hobby that we do to make the self more self-satisfied? That wouldn't honor the suffering in the world. So some of us, you know, go to third world countries and live there, right? Like Judith, and do work in those little villages. And others of us, you know, have to kind of see this, play this moment to moment. But to work on your own motivation for practice. Are you indeed here to help the suffering of the world? In that case, it might not look like bringing the Dharma directly to somebody. It might look like bringing the Dharma to myself and then figuring out, how do I translate this into something else? Yeah. And you know, that there's like, everybody should practice Buddhism, so we have to make, you know, but maybe not. Maybe not. But maybe I should. And then finding the way to use up your life in service to the suffering that you actually perceive. My belief is that we do that through learning about our own suffering and not excluding the suffering of others. And seeing how it's the same.
You know, strikes me that as I say that about the world, that it's also inside. And there are just as much random thoughts and feelings and, you know, events in my history that I bring to this moment that I think you're talking about that need to be welcomed. And,
yeah.
You know,
but and I think appreciate this point on it's at every level. Mm-hmm. So the self and the parts of ourself that are acceptable and not acceptable, and then on the social construction level about, you know, this particular place and who's here and who's not here, and being aware of who and how what our part is in that. To keep looking at that, I think so important. So thank you. And one last Esther.
So what I wanted to say just changed a little to the story where the sharing of that, because not so long ago I went into a phone shop to have a phone fixed that fell on the floor. And I talked to a young man, and he was he had a background from Pakistan. And as we talked about the phone, the exchange turned into a talk about Zen. and why I'm thinking of the story was that, you know, our moments of meeting or our sangha or and our inclusion of everything can happen everywhere. And in my country, we have the same situation. Mostly middle class white people come to Zen, but I find that everywhere that I move around, there's always an opportunity for some kind of, or there is sangha. And so we will meet, and we can share the Dharma in so many ways, and so unintended, really, but just from being present with each other or seeing each other and having eye contact and acknowledging there's another person there. And so there's something there about we can try to figure out the ways to have an inclusive practice and what should I do in my little group and how should I invite people, but maybe the group is already there. It's just outside my door, and the next person I meet is the next person I practice with or am with.
Great.
To notice.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's practice.